Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. We'll be talking about the recent rawhide treat recalls, take a look at new spaying and neutering guidelines, tell you about our breed of the month, and of course, answer your pet care questions. So join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Love to hear from you. And Dr. Sandy, welcome back. Great
nice
to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Larry.
And, you know, I'm amazed that at this recall on rawhides because it's growing.
Yeah, and, you know, this is the big issue that I have is that, first of all, rawhide itself is one of those things where, as a veterinarian, I'm always telling people you've got to use caution. So kind of my rules of just general rules of rawhide are that, you know, one, if your pet is overweight, they should not be getting rawhide. It is really high in calories. I think people look at it as a chew toy or something, but it's super high in calories, and some dogs can consume it so quickly, it's going to add to their waistline. You know, you have to make sure that you size it appropriately for your dog and that it's the right shape. Those flat, like, chips are usually the best, especially for chewing puppies, but you can't leave them alone with it because there's a high chance of choking. So it always needs to be down, supervised, and then being able to take it away. And that can sometimes be a trick too, because sometimes we have pets that kind of look at that like I do a box of chocolates. You know, it's like, yeah, don't touch my chocolates. I want, those are mine. The dog may be the same way with that rawhide, and you may start having a little bit of conflict if you're trying to get it away from them. So you do need to be able to make sure that it's not going to be a high ticket item that these dogs are going to want to try to protect. And other things is, you never want to use this stuff called compressed rawhide. It's where they take layer after layer after layer and with pressure and heat condense it down into a really super hard bone. And I'm not talking about the rolled stuff that's knotted and turned into a bone, but the really hard stuff that looks like a cartoon-shaped bone. Those are hard enough that we do see tooth fractures, that can cause root exposure. And, you know, it's unless you've got an extra $1,500 sitting around that you want to have to get those teeth fixed, don't use it. But on top of that, Now we have this issue with a recall. I mean, I'm always telling people, use rawhide that is made in the United States, that it doesn't come from an outside country. And that is really tough to find that information because, like, just looking at this, how wide this recall has been, it's stuff that's even been sold. Like, I was in our local Century grocery store, and the brand of rawhide that they carry there is on the recall list. Even things like, you know, at Petco, one of the local big pet stores, super pet store type things, they sell pet the stuff there that's been recalled. And yet, it's still on the shelves and people are still able to buy it. And so you want to make sure that everything, it's made in the United States. And it's because periodically these recalls come up. This particular recall is because a lot of this rawhide, and it covers so many different brands. I really can't get into all the brands on the air. You can go to the FDA site. They have a site on recalled products, and especially one for pets, and they have them all listed there. Check your labels, but the product that it's been tainted with is something called quaternary ammonia compounds, and these are used as disinfectants and surfactants, and in our world, we'll use them even as fabric softeners, and so what in the world are they doing in rawhide? I don't know, but they can cause gastric upset, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, sometimes bad enough that it may require veterinary care. The thing that's going to be the telltale sign is they do have a funny odor to them. So if you open up a package of this rawhide that maybe you've had on your shelf that you bought a couple of months ago, and it's got an odor that just doesn't smell right to you, double check and make sure. You can take it back, get your money back at any of the stores that carry this.
Oh, well, stay away from them.
Yes, I think just rawhide in general, probably not safe for the majority of pets.
Okay. Well, Sally in Dubuque, Iowa has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Sally.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Good. I have a question. I have a 10-year-old little Chihuahua Min Pin mix, and I noticed the last few months that his ribs are showing more. And I have been, you know, taking his weight since May, and he's fluctuated anywhere from like 10 pounds to 10.6, so not a dramatic weight loss or anything. I did take him into the vet, and they did some liver panels and then an ultrasound on his liver and kidney, and everything was normal. I'm wondering if there's anything else I'm missing. It's just feels so weird to pet him and to get his ribs.
And you're doing all the right stuff. I mean, anytime we have weight change, whether it's up or down, those are things that have us concerned. And sometimes we can have a dog actually losing muscle mass, but their weight is staying the same because they're building up fluid in their abdomen or maybe fat in their abdomen, but they're losing muscle mass. And normal aging change does sometimes cause some shift in the way muscling is, you know, depending on how much exercise they're getting. You may start seeing some changes in how they're built. But I totally agree with what you did. You went to your veterinarian, you looked for potential causes for protein loss, like is your dog losing muscle mass because of protein loss through the kidneys? So I hope you got a urine sample checked. Do you have something going on like heart disease? A small breed dog, heart problems can sometimes cause weight loss as well. Liver issues. Liver is really one of those important organs that helps make albumin, one of the big proteins in the body. And sometimes we can see weight shifts and changes with liver disease. So you've already gone down that path. So, you know, I think that if you've ruled out all the real important disease, it may just be one of these kind of age-related type things. Mm-hmm. I would recommend that you also don't get kind of sucked into the, I have a senior pet, I need to put them on a senior diet. There are lots of skinny seniors that need extra calories and need the, you know, to have that to just keep themselves healthy versus some of the senior diets that are out there that are lower in calories and higher in fiber. So, you know, not all seniors are created equal. So maybe, you know, that would be one thing is go back to the diet that you have your pet on. And if it would be safe to go to something that maybe has a little more calories in it to just get your dog a little heavier, if that's possible. And, you know, for a 10-pound dog, a half a pound of weight change is it can be still pretty significant. And so that little fluctuation you're seeing may be, you know, what's showing up on those ribs.
Okay, and they did not do a urine sample, and I don't think they did anything to rule in or out any heart problems.
Okay, that would be two things that I'd be looking at, is making sure that you don't have something called cardiac cachexia, which is where with heart disease, they can start running into issues with losing body weight. And so making sure that your dog doesn't have a heart murmur or anything that way, it's pretty easy. You just have to lay your stethoscope on the chest and listen for an irregular heartbeat or a murmur, which would indicate that you've got some changes in the blood flow through the chambers of the heart. Getting a urine sample, that would be something easy enough for you to do. You could collect a first morning urine sample. That's always the most valuable sample, at least in my my point of view, is because it's going to show how well the kidneys are working, concentrating, because your dog hasn't been up drinking water all night long, hopefully. And then it would also let us know kind of how much protein and things is being lost. They'll have a look at that sample and then decide if they have to go any further with any further testing. And I think that would be, that if that hasn't been done, that would be definitely something that should be looked into.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I was going to mention at the start of the show about the National Guidelines for Spaying and Neutering, and I wanted to get that in before I forgot.
Right, because it's such an important topic this time of the year. It's kitten season, and we are, you know, most rescue groups are being inundated with kittens. You know, as a veterinarian in the past, we would typically be recommending that, you know, cats be spayed or neutered by 6 months of age. Well, I mean, I've had in my private practice experience kitties that are as young as like 14, 15 weeks of age already coming into heat.
Oh.
And they can, by the time that they are 6 months of age, already have a litter on the ground because their period from when they're bred to when they deliver is going to be, usually about 63, 64 days. So there you go. Do the math. So there was a group of not only veterinarians, but also experts in lots of different fields in the veterinary field, including, feline health research and behavior and so on. And what they've come down to is that cats should be spayed or neutered by 5 months of age. That way, if the female is pregnant, the pregnancy can be terminated before the kittens get too big. And it's going to stop some of the behavior problems like urine marking and spraying that may happen when they start getting into puberty. And it will also decrease risks of things like mammary tumors, which are, compared to dogs, in cats, they're almost always malignant. So it can be a real problem for them that way. And what I want to see is all these kitties that are out there that are homeless, adopted, less cats getting into the rescue group and less cats being relinquished because guess what? I'm in heat and I'm yowling and I'm keeping the owner awake and I don't want you anymore because you're bothering me. So 5 months of age, by 16 weeks of age, everybody should be vaccinated and be finished with their vaccines. And so that gives you lots of time to get that done. And we can actually spay and neuter cats even earlier than that, as early as 6 weeks to 14 weeks of age. We will do it earlier, but 5 months is like the latest
that's
we want to do it.
Deadline for sure.
The deadline for
Drop
sure.
Deadline.
Oh, I mean, we'll do it anytime, but even if it's after that, but we want to try to get it done. If it's an elective procedure, the cat's owned by somebody, get it done by 5 months.
Chris in Watertown, thank you for waiting. Hi, what's on your mind?
Hi, speaking of kitties, I have one wonderful kitty who unfortunately has inflammation of her lining of her intestines and her stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And I have her on steroids, which is not the final answer because steroids can have a lot of side effects. And so I've talked with her vet. And we really would like to explore the idea of probiotics or enzymes and such. I, ironically, have also irritable bowel syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And I've tried probiotics and have had adverse effects. So any advice on good probiotics, enzymes for kitties with inflammation?
Well, the first thing I would be recommending is before you start changing bacterial flora and so on, which may be necessary, but there's other ways of going about doing that. Have you had your cat on a hydrolyzed protein diet trial to see if your cat has a food allergy? Because for many of these cats, sometimes we don't get a diagnosis. We don't know what causes this in many cats. And the symptoms for IBD in cats can vary from just, a decrease in appetite, vomiting only, vomiting and diarrhea, diarrhea only, maybe weight loss, maybe the weight's stable. Sometimes it's just something like persistent, I'm putting this in quotations, hairballs. I think the hair is just going along for the ride. The cat's vomiting because it's got something else going on. And probably the first thing that I ever do is put them on a hypoallergenic diet. And that doesn't mean just going to the grocery store or the pet store and buying a new food that maybe is a venison food or a rabbit diet, because the over-the-counter diets are not made in a plant that's been totally cleaned out, and there may be offending ingredients still in there, even though they're not on the label. And so going with a therapeutic diet that you would get from your veterinarian is the way to go. And there are several of them on the market, so you don't have to just stay with one. And if your veterinarian only carries maybe one brand, there are online pharmacies that carry prescription diets that you can get prescriptions and order them to try different ones for your cats as well. Whenever I have a cat like this, I always send them home with a little goodie bag of a can of this and a can of that and a little bag of this and that. So the owner can do kind of a buffet food trial to say, what does my cat like best? And then they can just use those foods. And that helps a great majority of them. Have you done that yet? Have you been on, had your cat on a special diet?
Well, first of all, she is the pickiest eater in the world, and she will only eat anything salmon-flavored. But is it hydrolyzed?
It's hydrolyzed, and what I mean by that is they've taken protein and broken it down into little bits that the body doesn't recognize where it came from. And there are some other very limited antigen diets that are, and it's usually the protein that cats are allergic to, that are made by manufacturers that, again, you're not going to be able to find over the counter, but you will be able to get, you know, from your veterinarian. One of the companies that comes to mind is a company called Royal Canin. They even though it's got canin in their name, it is for cats as well. And they do make some that are different flavors, but it's going to be very novel proteins that you probably are not going to be involving fish. That's why you have to do a food trial where you leave her regular diet out and you just put a little bowl of this new stuff nearby and say, hey, what do you think of this? You know, you don't want to taint her food that she's currently eating where she's like, I'm not going to touch anything because you hide stuff in it. But you want to just see, will she eat this? And sample dries and cans as well. And so if she is only eating salmon, seafood's on that the top of the list for dietary allergies in cats. So it may be time that we find something else that she likes to eat.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn and her guests talk about how we read and why so many people can't and what can be done about it. That's at 2 o'clock. Right now, taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. We'll go back to the phones and Phyllis in De Pere up next. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi. I'm so glad to be able to ask this question. I'd like to know what she knows about the, it's called the 4DX SNAP test. Could you tell us how this test compares to other tests? What all does it check for?
Mm-hmm.
And what's your opinion about it? Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. This is a test that the clinic that I work at, the UW Veterinary Care, we use all the time. It's run on a daily basis. It's a test that is used for dogs. And it's a test, the reason why the number 4 is, and it is actually looking at 4 different diagnostic things. And we basically break it down into 2 categories. One is heartworm. And the heartworm test that we're doing is something that's looking, it's called a heartworm antigen test. It looks for proteins that are released from the adult heartworm. So that's the limitation on the test. It will not give you, and there really isn't a test out there that looks for the immature stages because it takes about 6 or 7 months from when a dog is bit by a mosquito until you can actually pick it up on the heartworm test. And so that's one of the limitations with this. So we tend to try to time running this test when we have the greatest chance if there's been a lapse in heartworm preventative to be able to get a positive if they're going to be positive. The other kind of half of the test, or actually 3/4 of the test, is looking at the top 3 tick-borne diseases that we have in our state, as well as around the country. It looks for Lyme disease. And so that is actually looking for what's called C6 antibodies, which is a antibody test that is not interfered with by vaccine, because the vaccine for Lyme disease is not 100% effective. It's pretty good, and we still recommend dogs be vaccinated for it, especially if you're in heavy tick areas, but sometimes we do see breakthrough. And so if we get a positive Lyme test back, that means that the pet has been exposed. Doesn't necessarily mean they're going to get sick with the disease. It just indicates exposure. The other two tests are for anaplasmosis, which is also spread by the deer tick, and ehrlichiosis. Two different types of ehrlichia are screened for as well, which we're seeing more and more of, especially up in the northern part of Wisconsin. So it's a nice general screening test that for dogs that kind of picks up on those things. The big thing we use it for primarily is to really bring it, run, you know, drive it home that you need year-round tick control in this state, because we see so many dogs that test positive, not necessarily become clinical, but test positive for one of these tick-borne diseases. And then, you know, we ask the owner, well, do you use year-round tick control? And they're like, no, I stop in the winter. And I'm like, no, you can't do that, because deer ticks love that temperature in that 30 to 40 degree range, 32 to 40 degree range. So they like the cooler weather. So that, and the reason why it's called a SNAP test is it just takes a couple of drops of blood. And it's a little plastic container, single test, single use, drop of blood, you push a button down, and boom, you get your answer, usually within just a matter of a few minutes. So it can often be run patient side. We send ours down to our lab because we have a lab tech that runs all of these, but that's why veterinarians like it, and it's a very reliable test to be able to run. Although, I'll just say this, I did have a dog in the other day that was tested heartworm positive weekly on this test. They use year-round heartworm control. And I was like, what is wrong with this? You know, why is this dog testing positive? We ran a different platform heartworm test, and it came back negative. And so sometimes you do, on rare occasions, get false positives. And so there may be some follow-up necessary. But all in all, it's a very reliable test.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Mary in Lake Gogebic, I believe it is, Michigan.
Hello there. Hi, everyone. We have a 12-year-old big orange male type cat. He found us as a stray about 10 years ago. So we took him in. We didn't have any other animals. We had him neutered and all his shots. And soon after that, he got very sick. And after a blood transfusion and other things, it was discovered he had feline AIDS. That we were told. And as long as we kept him on a very low dose of prednisone, he has thrived for 10 plus years that we've had him. However, over the winter, he started getting these small but strange skin growths over his head or shoulder area. And I kind of thought, well, maybe they're old kitty type growths, but they would get kind of picky or scabby and fall off. So I took him in, and we did two Covenia injections, and that seemed to do the trick, and they kind of dried up, and he was clear again until this past June, where he just seemed to be kind of covered, or many.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And now we're doing our third Covenia injection this Thursday, and they are drying up, but they're kind of crusty little scabs that you can almost pick off, mm-hmm. And then there's like a tuft of hair with some skin cells, obviously.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad that you brought up this thing about FIV in cats or cat AIDS. Many cats with FIV can survive for years as long as they're kept healthy, good plane of nutrition, you deal with kind of secondary infections and things. They can often do very, very well. The little sores that you're bringing up and talking about sounds like a condition that we see in cats. It's called miliary dermatitis, and they're like little tiny scabs that will often occur around the neck, on the head, sometimes down the back, sometimes all over the body. And when we see those, there's a number of things that we think about. It's very possible it could be due to a bacterial infection. And I would recommend, rather than just continuing on with these long-lasting antibacterial injections, and that's what Convenia is it's a two-week antibiotic, and it's very convenient, thus the name Convenia, so because you don't have to medicate your cat on a daily basis. But the downside is with repeated use, if your cat has a skin infection, you may start selecting for resistant bacteria. So you may want to have your veterinarian do a culture before they start doing more injections, just to see what's growing there and what would be an appropriate antibiotic. The other thing that we'll see causing miliary dermatitis in cats besides infection is allergic skin disease. And probably the top allergy in cats that we'll see is flea allergy dermatitis. And the typical presentation is like what you're describing. And so when you were saying, well, it happened in December, so, you know, fleas aren't usually outside in December, but they definitely are in your house, because fleas that came in maybe in the late summer or fall can take, from an egg stage to an adult, can take a couple of months to develop. And so did you have something with fleas being a problem? And now we're heading into flea season now. So I'm just thinking off the top of my head, do we have something like that going on? So I'd be making sure, even if your cat is inside 100% of the time, they should be on flea and tick control. So I would be recommending that your veterinarian do that. Then the next step would be considering biopsying one of these lesions, and that would be just a little biopsy punch, or be looking into other allergic type problems that could be causing your cat to have problems like this. And that may involve things like blood testing, skin testing, a food trial, kind of going down that path. If that's not something that your veterinarian is comfortable with, this may require a visit to a veterinary dermatologist. And I know you're in Michigan. They have a wonderful vet school there with a veterinary derm department, and that would be some place that you may want to consider getting a referral to.
There we go.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Lara in Auroraville. New spot for us, I think.
Hi, Larry.
Hi.
Thank you for having me. My question is about deer flies. So I take my dog for long walks every day, and they attack the backs of her ears and her back and tail. And I'm wondering if there's something you would recommend that's safe to use on animals to repel either deer flies or mosquitoes.
Yeah, there are some products that are flea and tick products that also have on the label for controlling mosquitoes and biting flies as well. And the two that come to mind are Advantix, which you can buy over the counter. Some veterinarians carry it. You can get it at pet stores, at, you know, the like farm type supply stores and so on. But that would be one. The active ingredient in that is besides the flea ingredient, which is called imidacloprid, which has no effect on biting flies or anything like that, is permethrin. And so you have to be careful with using that, that you use the right dose, that you apply it appropriately, that if you've got cats at home, that you keep them separated. The other product that you may be able to get from your veterinarian is called Vectra 3D, and that would be another one to be looking into as well. There's others on the market too that your veterinarian may recommend, but you're looking for something that's a spot-on product that contains a permethrin. If you're looking for just topical treatment that you can use on an as-needed basis, there are various lotions, roll-ons, and so on that have the natural type of pyrethrin that's called permethrin. It doesn't last that long, but it is safe for topical application, and you'll find that in pet supply catalogs. I see it at our local farm store here in Madison, and so they sell them usually where they sell horse supplies. And they're usually a roll-on that you can put on the ear tips. Or you can do what I do. You know, you put on the dog doesn't mind wearing a hat or covering, like sometimes just putting some covering over them. Having something, I don't know if this works for you, Larry, but I found that just putting like a long stalk of grass kind of behind my ear and having it up high, they tend to swarm around that and not my head as much. But again, I don't know if that would work for your dog to have something, you know, up high bothering them. That may bother them more than not. But look for some of these other products. I think that's your best way to go.
I don't have enough hair to keep a straw up. Oh, yeah. Oh, my head. Oh, man. Lara, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jennifer on Facebook says her cat is pulling out hair around his hind area and tail. Vet says it could be allergies, no visible signs of irritation on the skin. She did apply a topical treatment for fleas, ticks, and it seemed to help because he stopped for a while, but she hasn't reapplied. Now he's back to pulling out hair. Could this be itchy skin, or could we try over-the-counter hydrocortisone spray again? There's no visible skin or sign of irritation on the skin.
Well, this could definitely be fleas. You know, just like the last one of the last callers where we had this issue with miliary dermatitis, flea allergy dermatitis in cats can present in many, many different forms. The fact that the cat got better with an application of flea control products makes me think that you probably have a flea problem. Remember, when you're treating fleas, the flea that you find on your pet is from an egg that was laid approximately 2 months ago. And so when we're treating to be able to get rid of all those early stages, the eggs, the larvae, the cocoon stages, which are resistant to anything you throw at them because they're protected in this little cocoon that are all in the environment, you need to treat the pet every month for at least 3 consecutive months. On top of that, vacuuming your home and taking care of your home. Don't necessarily have to do flea bombings or hire an exterminator because the cat's going to act as the flea control agent. But I would be looking at continuing on with that flea control. Even indoor cats can get fleas. My last case that I had was a strictly indoor cat, lived in an apartment building, but that was a communal apartment building where they had a hallway, neighbors had dogs, dogs were coming and going, and the cat lived in the apartment and never went out in the hallway, but the owners did, and probably brought fleas in that jumped onto the cat and started the whole cycle, and so their apartment was infested. So it can happen. And so get back into using that flea control. Don't be putting steroids on your cat yet.
Cheryl sent us a video on Facebook of her dog having a lot of fun with the hose.
Oh, my goodness. You know, I have a dog that has a little bit of a compulsive disorder. This is my bulldog, Pete. And he eats his breakfast and then runs outside and stands there and looks in the patio door because he wants to get sprayed with the hose. And it's not just biting the water. He races around the backyard and he jumps through the water like Superman. Yes, a bulldog off the air, through the water, and he will do this until we have snow on the ground and we have to put the hose away. And it takes him about a week after the hose is gone to realize it's not coming out again. But yeah, that is one of his favorite things to do. And what a great game for a hot summer day to be chasing water like that.
Oh, yeah. And that's a really cool video. If you have a video of your pet or just a photo of your pet, Sandy and I always love to see them. So you can post them up on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our page, The Larry Mueller Show. You have to be a member or have liked the page in order to post, but you can look and not have to be a member of Facebook. So there you go. So I'm hoping to see some more photos of your pet. Let's go to Ann in Appleton next. Ann, thank you for calling. Hello.
Yes, hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So always good to have Dr. on. Anyway, my comment is this, and I know that things change, different things we see in animals, but I adopted a fantastic dog. He was a pup. He was saved from a kill shelter down in southern Illinois. And anyway, he had a couple things that whenever he is, whenever they looked at these, they said, where did this dog come from? Like he came from South America or something. But he has, and I guess it's something that he will apparently live with. He has a particular kind of parasite called capillaria.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually had to send his fecal to Canada. We did an off-the-label treatment with megadoses of a wormer. It was throughout his entire body. At first they called it a lung worm.
Mm-hmm.
But then he also had a thing where he had what appeared to be an abscess on his leg. And upon trying to clean it with some peroxide, a little piece of white came out of his leg. And I started to get a little pair of tweezers and pull it.
Yeah.
And I kept pulling it. and pulling it, and I'm like, oh my goodness, am I pulling out muscle fascia or what?
Oh my goodness.
And after I got to about 9 inches of this, I'm like, oh my goodness, what is this? And I cut it off, I put it in water, and took it into the vet. And he had a thing called a guinea worm.
Yeah, it's also called a dracunculosis. That's the funky name for it. And I'm going to just bring up a website that is open to everybody, not just veterinarians, but it's because I have never diagnosed guinea worm or dracunculosis before. As you're talking, I'm very quickly going online here and looking this up. But the site that I recommend if you have any questions on parasites, lots of good references there, is the Companion Animal Parasite Council. And their website is CAPCVET, CAPCVET.org. And on there is like the alphabet from A to Z under their guidelines. And you have to know that guinea worm is also dracunculosis to be able to look it up. But you under D, and it gives you the whole thing with videos. If people want to see what you saw, they can go online and actually see one of these things being extracted from a dog. It's a very uncommon parasite, but it is seen in our raccoon population and some of the other kind of wild canids that are around. So poor dog must have spent a lot of time outside.
Well, he was. He had never even been in a house before. He'd never walked through a door before. So he had a lot of issues with, just really trying to get him more or less accustomed to society. So I did take him in, and he had acupuncture, and that was just incredible. I worked with him at night. I walked him at night so he wouldn't be afraid of the trucks and all that. He had a hard life. But acupuncture is just phenomenal for getting their chi corrected.
I'm so glad that that's helped him emotionally.
Oh, he's a fantastic dog.
Yeah, and, just back to this guinea worm thing, you cured your dog because there is nothing medically that can treat these. It's surgical removal. And so the body...
there's no way you know he has it until...
you get a raised bump and you do surgery and open it up and find what it is. So be on the lookout for more of them. They're very, very creepy, and I'm glad that I was not the veterinarian involved with your pet's care.
I'm the one that took it out. They just had to look at it in the water.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Well, thank you so much for calling us. An unusual kind of situation there.
38 years, I've never seen it, but I have heard of them, but I am just grateful that that one has never crossed my path, because I think I would lose my lunch. Yeah.
Oh, man. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, from the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Looking at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for tuning in. Every one of our phone lines is filled. So let's go to Tony in Wisconsin Dells and see what's on Tony's mind. Hi.
Hello. I have a dog that's about 9 years old, been very healthy. In fact, just had her to the vet, in May, end of May, for her test for heartworm and all the stuff that needs to be done for spring. But she's had this happen twice. Once it happened maybe like a year ago, and it was kind of like, I thought, a fluke. Happened again just in the last week or so, where in her sleep she urinates. And she doesn't seem to have any problems with urine issues or anything like that I've seen, and none of her veterinary checks have ever shown issues with that.
Okay.
But, where she was sleeping, I went over there, and she was just starting to wake up, and there was this big puddle.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't seem to be bothered by the concern, and we went outside, and she urinated normally.
Okay.
And I always take her out before we go to bed to make sure she urinates then, too. But I don't know if it was just a fluke kind of thing. The first time it happened, I wasn't sure what happened and, whatever. The second time was like,
Yeah, so a number of things come to mind. It sounds like it's very intermittent, so I don't know if it's something that we need to be jumping on therapy right away. Mm-hmm. But it's very common for spayed female dogs, as they get older, to have a weak bladder sphincter, that when they, especially if they lay down and they're really super relaxed and maybe they had a lot of water before they went to bed, mm-hmm. that they produce urine, and it's just because of abdominal pressures and them being relaxed, they just start leaking a little bit. And uh-huh. so it usually happens when they're sleeping, but often dogs that are incontinent, it's going to be a daily thing. You may see it even during the day when they're laying down. A few drops of urine may come out. And in that case, then we start thinking about, okay, we better get her on some type of medication that's going to tighten that bladder sphincter. And there's a several different things that we can use. They all have their own individual side effects and so on. But I don't know if your dog is ready for that. The other thing I'd be wondering about is she having, like, some type of a seizure disorder? A lot of times seizures occur at night, and when they do, they will sometimes urinate or defecate. But it doesn't, again, I would expect that you would see her bed messed up or maybe her waking up a little disoriented. Doesn't sound like that's going on either. Yeah. I'd, you know, being a 9-year-old dog that's done this before, I would say a minimum would be get a urine sample, first morning urine sample. You can go out and collect it. Some people will use, depending on the size of the dog, like an old soup ladle or something to slide underneath so that they can collect that sample. Bring it into your veterinarian for a urinalysis to make sure that the kidneys are functioning normally, meaning that the urine's well concentrated, that there's no indication of infection or something like that that could be causing a problem. And then take things from there, maybe some blood work if necessary. But two episodes, again, how far do you go with this? But I think it should definitely be on your radar and something that you may want to be watching.
Well, the one thing that we have decided to do is to stop giving her water at about 8 o'clock at night,
mm-hmm.
and then, you know, just let her have all the water she wants during the day. And she seems to be quite a drinker, and she urinates often, so, you know, a healthy urine kind of thing.
Okay.
But we've done that, and that's, you know, and again, we're just waiting to see how that goes. But I'll keep an eye on the other things, and I may just try to collect that sample.
Yeah. So, be careful with water deprivation, because there's a number of health problems that older dogs can run into troubles with that requires them to drink. If not, they get dehydrated. So one thing that you may want to do is before you start putting the water away and saying you can't have any after 8 o'clock, do a 24-hour water intake study, which just means you put in a measured amount in the bowl, and anytime you have to dump the bowl out, you measure how much water you're getting rid of. Anytime you add water, you measure it, and at the end of 24 hours, you know this is how much she took in. As veterinarians, we know kind of what the average level is for dogs that they should be drinking. And if you present that information to your veterinarian, they can say, you know what? Your dog is polydipsic, which means drinking too much water. It may just be that she likes water, but there could be a medical basis for it as well. So before I'd start depriving her of water, even though it's just for the evening, there may still be a medical need for her to be drinking.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Speaking of watering, there are these watering devices for cats that have the water kind of coming up and flowing over the side, mm-hmm. and there's a filter in there. How often should that be changed?
Fairly frequently, because I mean, at least my luck with those things have been that the little pump gets all lined up very quickly and then it loses its efficacy. A lot of cats really like running water, but I would be at least, you know, probably dumping it and refreshing it daily, just to make sure that they have fresh water going through there, because, you know, some cats only want to drink fresh water. Some only like to drink water dripping from a faucet. And so the fresher you can make it, the better odds are that the cat's going to drink it.
Let's move on to Bill in Wisconsin Dells next. Bill, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello?
Hi. What's on your mind? Bill, Bill, are you there?
Hello?
Yep. Hi.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, here's my dilemma. My wife and I have a 12-year-old miniature poodle, and we took her into the vet last Wednesday, and the vet, you know, gave her shots. she cleaned her ears out. Well, ever since then, she's deaf.
My goodness. Yeah.
I mean, we're very concerned about that.
Yeah.
Other than that, you know, she's...
And
that,
this, yeah, you know, anytime if you do vigorous ear cleaning, especially if you've got a diseased ear and the eardrum is inflamed, there is that opportunity to rupture the eardrum. And, that may be what happened. And I don't know if that's what happened, but I think it would be worthwhile calling your veterinarian and saying, hey, I think my dog is deaf, because you can visualize the eardrum with an otoscope cone and get down in there and have a look. And I would hope that your veterinarian had looked in the ears before they cleaned to kind of see, is there an eardrum there or not? Because if there wasn't, some of the cleaning agents we use, especially chlorhexidine, or some of the medications that are used for treating ears, the aminoglycosides, which are a class of antibiotics that are in a lot of the ear medications, can be ototoxic to the nerve that's involved with hearing. And so we have to be careful if we have a ruptured eardrum and we need to clean the ears. I think it's time to go back to your veterinarian and say, what did you see when you looked in the ear? How did you clean my dog's ear out? Because if they used an ear bulb syringe, sometimes that can increase pressure and can rupture the eardrum. You have to be very careful with using those things. And then have them reevaluate the dog. If it's just a ruptured eardrum, your dog's hearing should return. And that will be, just a matter of probably a few weeks to allow that eardrum to heal. And they often do heal. So,
all right.
Good luck. I am so sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but she is going into the vet Wednesday for surgery for teeth. I know, I'm sure miniature poodles have teeth problem.
Oh, yes, they do, especially at 12 years of age. That would be the perfect time to say, while she's asleep, please have a really good look down in that ear canal. Because when it's awake, especially if their ears are sore, you can't get a good look. And often we do have to sedate dogs to do thorough ear cleanings. So this would be a perfect time to do the recheck, is when she's in for her dental procedure.
Yeah. Good enough. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. And let's go to Charlie in Oxford next. Hi, Charlie.
Yeah, I'm the second one with a question about ears and deafness. I took my cat in a couple months back to have her ears checked. She's about 7, because she was scratching and I thought it was ear mites. The vet looked under a microscope, took a sample and said no, there are no ear mites, but it was bacterial, and gave me some Tresiderm, which I've been giving the cat, but I guess I wasn't really good at giving it to her every day, but I've been really good for the last week.
Okay.
And now I ran out of it, and I was looking online to buy some a little cheaper.
Uh-huh.
And anyway, so some people were saying the drug itself made their animals deaf. And so I was concerned also, is it the Tresiderm that you were telling the last caller?
Yeah, I mean,
it's that can do that if there's a rupture.
Yeah, it's very possible, because it does have neomycin in it, which tends to be on the lower scale of causing ototoxicity. It's one of these kind of ear medications that have 3 different ingredients in it. It's got an antifungal agent, an antibiotic, and a steroid. We don't see ear infections in cats that often. And you were, Wright was saying, well, I mean, I wonder if it's ear mites. Very overdiagnosed. Cats get ear mites from contact with other cats, and I wouldn't be expecting a 7-year-old kitty, especially if they're indoors living by themselves, to suddenly contract ear mites. But your vet did the right thing, took a swab, looked under the microscope, saw bacteria, and said, let's try treating. if it's not getting better, now it's time to go back in and say, let's get another swab, look under the microscope. Has the bacterial population changed to something else? Should we be doing a culture? Or is there something else going on in the cat's ear that could be causing it to be getting a bacterial infection? We see kitties with things like ear tumors, ear canal tumors, not that commonly, but that would be something that I would be really concerned about, just because we can see things like that happening. And so I think it's time to go back in. They may have to up the ante to a totally different antibiotic, different frequency, maybe a more potent steroid if there's a lot of swelling, to be able to get your cat feeling better.
Good luck. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Jimmy in Mequonigo, it's your turn. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi. I'm so thrilled, Larry, that you have the doctor on today, because I have a wonderful success story to share with you and her and your listeners. And back in 2005, I had rescued a golden retriever. She was mangy, and she was only like 30 pounds, and we put her with my big male golden retriever, and she became just a wonderful dog. And then she developed cancer, and we took her to our local veterinarian, and he just had decided that, you know, there was no chance of her recovering, and we were recommended to put her down. And my nurse wife at the time contacted UW-Madison and talked to this wonderful doctor. And I'm a chef in Milwaukee, and we named her Rachel Ray. And and we brought her to the facility in Madison in a limousine, and you examined her and decided that there was to the best of my memory, there was a sort of a trial procedure that you guys could try on her, and you saved Rachel Ray's life.
Oh my goodness.
And she lived. I'm happy to tell you that she lived 10 beautiful years at 85 pounds.
Oh, lovely.
And she was happy her whole life. She just died about 2 weeks ago.
Oh, I'm sorry for that.
I know, but you know what? You gave her 10 wonderful years. And just for anybody else, we have a clinical trial site on our the vet school's website that have all the different trials listed there, and people can go there if they have a pet that's got a weird problem and they're wanting to see if there's something out there that maybe they can get helped with.
And we will take a look at the news, and then we'll be right back. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her along. Thank you for listening in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can post a question and or photo of your pet on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And Sandy, we have lots of great photos.
Dave
sent another photo of the hose.
Yes, and this is a German Shepherd playing in a little kiddie pool with the hose. And I was telling Larry, he's been to my house before, and so he knows how big the backyard was. This is where I used to live. One of my bulldogs, I was filling their kiddie pool up with the hose, and I'm back in the very far back corner of my yard. And what I see him do? Picking up the hose while it's running, up the stairs and through the dog door into my dining room. Yes. So, yes, that dogs can get into trouble with running water like that. Yes.
Oh, and there's some other great photos of kitties and dogs. So we'll get to those, hopefully. Laura in Green Bay has been waiting a bit, though. So let's go there. Laura, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I heard a conversation a few minutes ago about a 9-year-old female that had urinary incontinence.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a 4.5-month-old Irish setter
who is exhibiting the same problems, but she does it daily, sometimes 2-3 times a day. She drinks a ton of water. She'll drink a quart of water within 2 hours in the morning. She was prescribed a 28-day course of Clavamox when she was about 10 and a half, 11 weeks old for vaginitis and or a UTI. That seems to have cleared up with a urinalysis that was cleared up. Then last week I had my vet do a blood test for kidney or some kind of disease because she's drinking so much water. He said that was perfect. The kidney, the liver, the electrolytes, everything was perfect.
Good, good.
What do you think?
Yeah, you know, so when we have a young dog like this, and I assume she's not spayed yet, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So I start worrying about anatomical problems, and what the anatomical problems are can be very different things that can happen, but things like what we call ectopic ureters, where one of the tubes that leaves the kidney does not plug into the bladder in the right spot can cause dripping. Sometimes we will see vaginal strictures that will pool urine, and then that will cause some leaking and kind of recurrent urinary tract infections and problems that way. So I think that if you've ruled out medical reasons such as, I mean, a lot of puppies like to drink a lot of water. They just are kind of water, like they play in it and they drink a lot. But if you've ruled out issues with the kidneys via blood work, then I think it may be time to be looking at structural problems. And that may require a referral to someone that can do specialized imaging, where they can do some contrast studies or ultrasounds to be able to have a look at the bladder, the ureters, to make sure that they're okay. Even doing things like vaginoscopy to be able to have a look up into her vaginal tract to see if she has a stricture that could be causing troubles. But I think you're probably at that level now. She's awfully young and shouldn't be leaking pee at this point in her life.
Okay. Thank you so much for calling, and good luck to you as well. You know, Sandy, I forgot to mention the pet of the month, and we haven't spoken about the pet of the month yet.
And I had a request to talk about a certain type, and this is a cat this time, and it's the Maine Coon cat, one of my favorite cats, because not that I'm not a cat person, because I definitely am. I don't consider myself a cat or a dog person. But of all the cats, I think this one reminds me most of a dog, not just because of their size. They're very large cats. They're the biggest cat that we have coming into our clinics. But they're just, their personality is very, very dog-like. We consider these kind of like a giant breed dog, except it's a giant breed cat. And, you know, the males can get up to about 20 pounds. When they start getting over that, we start getting worried. People think that, oh, you know, it's a Maine Coon, they can be 30 pounds. Well, that's usually because they're overweight. But 20 pounds is probably the upper end. And for females, they're a little bit smaller, 9 to 12 pounds, maybe even a little bit heavier from that. But because they're giant breed cats, the health problems that we see with them, very similar to the health problems that we see with giant breed dogs. Mainly orthopedic diseases. They are one of the few breeds of cats that get hip dysplasia. And we can see hip problems in these cats. And so when we get them as, you know, as youngsters, we have to treat them like we do giant breed dogs. Not pushing them to grow too quickly, because they can take a long time to develop, and they may need to be staying on a kitten formula and be very regulated with what they eat for the first couple of years of their life, unlike most cats where the first year of their life we're doing that. Other things that we'll see are hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And as, again, this is a problem that we can see in large breed dogs, different forms of cardiomyopathy. And this means a heart muscle problem. And we're lucky now that there are DNA tests available. And so if you're considering getting a Maine Coon cat, this would be one of the things to be asking the breeder is, do they screen their breeding stock for cardiomyopathy, because it is a simple blood test that can be sent in. They also have an oddball disease that is pretty unique to them that's called spinal muscular atrophy. And again, a genetic test is available. And the reason why we screen for it is that there's no treatment for this. And it starts showing up very early in their life. Usually by the time they're 3 or 4 months of age, they become very unstable in their gait. They're unable to jump up. They lose a lot of their motor neurons, so they become very weak. They can live with it, but then they've got lifetime mobility problems. So lots of things like that to be thinking about. But, you know, they are great cats, but just remember, you're dealing with a giant breed. So don't push them to grow too quickly. Don't let them get overweight because of their risk of their different orthopedic diseases. And make sure you know what diseases you're dealing with so you can deal with a reputable breeder.
There we go. And I guess that business about overeating applies to every darn pet that's out there.
60% of the pets, that pretty much 60% that I see have a weight issue. And, you know, I just had a dog in the other day where it's a working breed that should be probably swimming 5 miles a day, running, doing a lot of stuff, and this dog's doing nothing. And it was morbidly overweight. And it was, you know, it's so sad that, you know, in the right hands, this dog would probably be okay. But, you know, cut down, put, like, as someone told me one time, just put the fork down. Don't feed your dog as much. Put them on an appropriate diet that would be a weight control diet that may help with their metabolism. Don't just take a regular diet and feed less of it because they may not be getting enough basic nutrients. And, you know, really work on getting that exercise, and whether it means going to doggy daycare, hiring dog walkers, whatever it may be, if you physically can't do it yourself. So, yep.
Let's go to Bob in Winthrop Harbor, Illinois next. Bob, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, hello. Thank you for taking my call, Dr. Sandy and Larry. Long story short, we moved to this area that's has a food source called a restaurant that's in our backyard. And we, over the last 3 years, have been able to trap and socialize a fair number of cats. What we found working with the ferals is that they seem to have they seem to all have to gravitate towards what we'll call digest-sensitive foods. And so I'm wondering, Dr. Sandy, if you know of any, and these are feral cats, some have been out for only a few months, so they're under a year, but most have been, you know, older males that have been 3 years or more outside. Do they have different nutritional needs than, say, a regular old house cat that's been brought up inside?
No, probably not. What I would be worried about if you're just seeing more gastrointestinal problems with them, the fact that they were outdoor cats, you know, parasitic issues, you know, making sure that they have been screened thoroughly for intestinal parasites, which may involve more than doing a fecal flotation. It may involve looking at getting a Giardia antigen test done. But there is another parasite that we can see that can be very difficult to treat called Trichomonas, which is, you know, one of these oddball parasites that shows up that can cause chronic diarrhea in cats. And it's a little bit difficult to diagnose. Once it's diagnosed, you kind of have to accept what you're dealing with. But they can, you know, have that be an issue. I'd also be making sure that you're screening these cats for feline leukemia and FIV, because sometimes we can see GI issues kind of chronically in these cats that are immunocompromised because of these diseases. And so I hope that that's part of your trapping and getting these cats in a healthy state, is having that blood work done as well.
If I can, yes, absolutely. They get a SNAP test, and now we're starting to retest them, the ones that we have,
because
we've been able to adopt a lot of them out. Generally, they're really healthy. It's just getting very expensive food-wise.
Yeah. But it in general, it's a very common problem in cats to just see this kind of some GI hypersensitivity. And, you know, whether it's just something minor that you, like one of the callers that called earlier asking about using probiotics as a way of trying to control IBD. I don't know if your cats have IBD. That may potentially be what it is, but that is a biopsy diagnosis. And so, I don't know if you've gone that far to say this is what we need to do, But, you know, working with your veterinarian to try different levels like high fat, low fiber foods, and then potentially being able to come up with an over-the-counter version that may have the same percentages that's going to be able to help you with your cats so that you can trap and treat and handle more and adopt out more. How good of you for doing that, though?
Yeah, thank you, Bob.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure, appreciate it. And Julie in Eau Claire, your turn now. Hi, Julie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a, she's at least 8 years old. She's a stray. She was just diagnosed with kidney disease. And they put her on Royal Canin renal support and sent home a sample box, and she doesn't like any of it, including the canned food. And I'd rather have her, you know, have a shorter life but be happy if you could name me two, three quality foods that I could mix with it.
Yeah, so don't just think that the Royal Canin is the only one that's out there. As we've said earlier in the show, I will send home a smorgasbord of foods because I'm very lucky that I have a big pet kitchen at the clinic that I work at, and we have lots of different samples of foods to try. But look into either trying the Hill's KD, the NF diet that Nestle Purina makes. So there's other ones out there that may or may not be more palatable for your cat. And so that would be the route that I would go. And, you know, besides that, the big thing with renal diets is they are lower in protein because the kidneys are involved with handling nitrogenous waste. And so we want to make sure that because cats are carnivores, that they get the amount of protein they need, but not too much. Make sure that it's very bioavailable but not getting more protein than they need. They tend to be higher in potassium. They tend to be lower in sodium. They tend to be a little bit lower in phosphorus because these are all things that can be a problem for cats with kidney disease. And so you can also be looking at, you know, is this something that you could do a homemade diet? And, you know, there are veterinary nutritionists that can help you with formulating homemade diets, too, if your cat won't eat one of these diets. But sometimes it comes down to, well, we'd love you to live a long life, but if you're not going to eat any of these diets, you've exhausted the, you know, trying all these different things, we feed whatever the cat will eat. But carefully monitor the phosphorus level, potassium level, things that we can adjust with different medications at home. We can add in potassium supplements. We can add in phosphate binders. And that may, again, help your cat to live a long life on a regular food.
Yeah. Now, those two that you listed, the Hill's and Nestle's, are they only to be gotten from a vet?
Yes, yes. Okay. Any of the specialized diets like that that are considered therapeutic diets are prescription because these diets would not be appropriate for something like a growing cat or a cat. I mean, a normal cat could eat these and do fine, but it wouldn't be appropriate for certain life stages. And so, you know, that's why they make them as a therapeutic diet.
Yeah, there we go.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling. Barbara in Ashland, it is your turn. Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I have a Labrador, and she had some work done on her anal glands about 3 weeks ago, and they found there was a pus in the anus, and they did the procedure of flushing, and now it looks like she's doing what she did before was licking, and I'm just wondering if there's something else wrong, or they did give me a medication called carprofen. Don't know if that would
What carprofen is an anti-inflammatory, and we use that for pain. And sometimes dogs that have anal gland abscesses, well, every dog that has an anal gland abscess, it hurts. And so if they can tolerate that medication as a pain control medication, that will help take down the inflammation and make the dog feel more comfortable. Many of these dogs need to be not only flushed, but medication needs to be infused into the gland in a form of an antibiotic and steroid combination. And sometimes we even put the dog on, depending on whether there's enough inflammation in the tissues around it or infection in the tissues around the anal gland. We'll put them on a systemic antibiotic as well. And then we get them back in again a week or so later to check on how the glands are doing. And depending on how they're doing, we may flush and reinfuse them again. If they're not getting better and they're constantly staying, getting obstructed and getting infected, then we go down that path of considering surgical removal. So I think that if you've been haven't been back to the vet in 3 weeks, it's time to go to your veterinarian and say, hey, we may need to do all this again. And it's unfortunate. It's one of those body parts that is a pain for everybody to deal with. Your pocketbook, the dog, and the veterinary staff, because yeah, they're not fun. But we want to make your dog more comfortable. So time to go back into the vet, because carprofen alone is not going to help clear up an infection.
Good luck, Barbara. Thank you for calling. Sam in Delavan, your turn. Hi, Sam.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess we're on a streak of gastrointestinal problems here.
Okay.
I've got a 12-year-old, she'll be 12 next month, Australian cattle dog, a female.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she has probably, I'm going to say for the past 7 or 8 months, had gastrointestinal problems. I mean, basically just at times explosive diarrhea, but just nonstop diarrhea. But she's being treated. I've seen 4 different vets for her. I'm going around and around in circles. She's been on Tylan pretty much the whole time, and she's been on prednisone, kind of a half tablet every 2 or 3 days. But it comes and goes. She may be fine for 6 weeks, and then it comes back and gets really bad again. My concern is that when she's in a period where she's dealing with this diarrhea, it's not actually, you know, to me it seems unusual. It's not urgent. She doesn't go any more often than she would normally go.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's just that when she goes, it's just, you know, a normal stool.
Yeah.
But she loses weight. I mean, she'll go for like 3 or 4 weeks like this.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. So I always have to ask, did you get a diagnosis? You've been to 4 veterinarians. What's her diagnosis?
Well, the diagnosis has been inflamed gastrointestinal tract.
How did they get to that? So this is, you know, so...
That's why I'm calling.
Okay. So this is the dilemma that we have, is that the intestinal tract isn't the easiest organ to look at, like the skin or the eyeball or the teeth. You know, you've got to sometimes go through some, jumping through some hoops and do what I call the GI extravaganza. So in a case like this, I mean, it sounds like your dog has what we call small bowel diarrhea. To kind of break this down into like the first year vet student, how do we approach these cases? We tend to look at the stool and say, okay, is there urgency? Is there blood? Is there mucus? What's the volume of the stool? Is there weight loss associated with it? And from what you're describing, it kind of breaks it down into, it's probably involving the small intestinal tract versus the colon. Because it's, you know, normal volume, large volume, it's the not increased frequency, there's no straining, there's no blood, there's no mucus, and she's losing weight. And so what I would be looking at in this case is, number one, getting a fecal done. Number two, not only getting a fecal flotation, but getting a Giardia antigen test done. Number three, deworming her for Giardia, regardless of what any of those tests came back as. We'd like to know if she has it or not, because we'd like to know what we need to do with the environment. But going through a round of fenbendazole, which is a broad-spectrum dewormer that would get Giardia, and we use it for 5 days in a row. We'll usually also accompany that with a drug called metronidazole. And so I would do that. The next thing I would do is get her in for a fasting gastrointestinal panel. And this gets sent out to Texas. It's one of the only places in the country that does it, where we're able to look at certain parameters like, what's her pancreas doing? Is it making enough enzymes to digest her food? What's her cobalamin level? What's her folate level? Which helps tell us what the bacteria in her small intestinal tract are doing. And so it's a good way of kind of getting a better assessment of her GI health. If that comes back normal, then the next step would probably be scoping and biopsies. And that would mean probably coming to a gastrointestinal specialist to get that done. So that's your GI extravaganza.
Oh, my goodness. That is an extravaganza.
It is, yes.
Well, Sandy, it is always a pleasure. And I hope we'll see you back again soon.
Yeah. Thanks, Larry.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk is a clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, and it's always great to have her come by. And thank you. I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's normally the way it works. Tomorrow, we'll look at a couple of books, one a novel about a canoe trip to northern Minnesota, the other about the bees that you can find in your backyard. So I hope you'll stay with us for that. Please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.